The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the July 4th, 2014 edition of The Week magazine. The main stories and how they were covered. Obama's tough decisions in Iraq. What happened? About 300 U.S. Special Forces soldiers began arriving in Iraq this week to gather intelligence and serve as military advisors to the country's faltering army, as the Obama administration decides whether to use airstrikes against a rampaging Islamic insurgency. Rebels from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, militant group, advanced to within 20 miles of Baghdad, and there was fierce fighting between the estimated 10,000 insurgents and government forces in several cities. President Obama pledged to take targeted and precise military action if and when we determine the situation on the ground requires it. But he and Secretary of State John Kerry reiterated that any help was conditional on Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki giving minority Sunnis and Kurds a greater role in governing the country. Al-Maliki, whose party won a plurality of seats in the parliamentary election in April, pushed back against calls for the formation of an emergency government comprising all ethnic and religious groups, saying that would represent a coup against the Constitution. The Sunni insurgents, who want to establish a fundamentalist Islamic caliphate stretching across Iraq and Syria, continued making significant territorial gains in provinces to the north and west of Baghdad and took complete control of the Iraq-Syria border. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad sent warplanes to bomb western Iraq for the first time, targeting strongholds of ISIS fighters who are also fighting his regime. Kurdish President Masoud Barzani warned that the breakup of the country along sectarian lines was all but inevitable. The insurgency, he said, had created a new reality and a new Iraq. What the editorial said: it's frustrating to watch territory hard won by U.S. troops fall to extremists, said Newsday. But we have to accept that determining Iraq's future is no longer our problem. It was not just Obama, but the American people who wanted out of Iraq. And our only concern now should be stopping ISIS from forming a safe haven for terrorists. But for any hope of long-term stability, al-Maliki has to go, said TheGuardian.com. The prime minister now sees himself as an embattled commander-in-chief, spending most of his time poring over military maps and planning counterattacks. He is not listening to America, the Sunnis, or even other Shiite leaders. He just wants to crush the insurgents and retain power. Ousting al-Maliki isn't the magic answer to Iraq's problems, said the Wall Street Journal. Good luck finding a suitable replacement. Someone popular with the Shiites, acceptable to the Sunnis and Kurds, reasonable toward Americans, and effective in the fight against terrorists. President Obama's public maneuvering against al-Maliki is simply drawing the authoritarian leader closer to his Shiite base and into the waiting arms of Iran. What the columnist said: there are no good options in Iraq right now, says Max Boot in the Los Angeles Times. Airstrikes, cruise missiles, and drone attacks are only effective when you have enough eyes on the ground to precisely target the strikes and a competent army to follow up. Allowing Iraq to divide into three ethnic regions, on the other hand, would essentially result in two terrorist states, a Tehran-backed Shiite region, and an ISIS-controlled Sunni area. So the least worst option is for Obama to prevent al-Maliki from having a third term in office by personally pressing Sunni and Shiite leaders to find a more inclusive figure. It's naive to think the U.S. can force al-Maliki out, said Fanar Haddad in WashingtonPost.com. He commands considerable popularity among the Shiites, and they're clinging to him more tightly because of existential fears created by the advance of ISIS militants and armed Sunni sympathizers. Sunnis, meanwhile, are so embittered they will reject any Shiite prime minister. That leaves Obama with a difficult conundrum, said Megan L. O'Sullivan in Politico.com. He can take his usual cautious, incremental approaches and keep pressing for a political solution, but in the meantime, ISIS can consolidate its territorial gains. Or Obama can launch airstrikes now, push ISIS back, and lose his leverage over al-Maliki. Either way, Iraq may be headed for a breakup. A second main story, a win for GOP old guard. In a surprise turnaround, an incumbent U.S. Senator Thad Cochran this week won a runoff election for the Mississippi GOP Senate nomination against Tea Party-backed challenger Chris McDaniel. The Tea Partier, who beat Cochran in the initial primary but fell short of the majority needed for nomination, refused to immediately concede and hinted at possible legal action to contest the 51-49% outcome, which Cochran, 76, won in part through a targeted appeal to African-American Democratic voters. The result was a blow to the Tea Party, which had hoped to build on its recent defeat of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. But six-term Senator Cochran aggressively defended his incumbency against McDaniel's anti-Washington crusade, arguing that Mississippi benefited from the federal aid he helped secure to build roads and schools. "This is your victory," Cochran told supporters. "You can rest assured that all I will be doing is thinking about you and bringing these resources home." The lesson for GOP incumbents is clear, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. "Run scared or run unopposed." Cochran's strategists deserve credit for reaching out to black voters, boosting overall turnout by nearly 60,000, and marking the first time in 30 years that a runoff election outdrew the initial primary. "Win or lose, the Tea Party is alive and well," said Larry Sabato in Politico.com. "Its activists now represent a significant faction of the GOP. Cochran's narrow victory should be a reminder that establishment Republicans can't wish this movement away and must work with its supporters to the extent possible." "The Tea Party should learn from this, too," said George Will in NationalReview.com. "Mississippi has the nation's highest federal funding as a percent of revenue, and Cochran's pledge to keep on serving up pork was ultimately more appealing than McDaniel's promise of smaller government. Even in deep red states like Mississippi, Americans' devotion to frugal government is frequently avowed, but rarely inhibiting." Our controversy of the week, the IRS. Could learners' emails really just evaporate? "Well, that didn't go very well," said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. IRS Commissioner John Cochran was summoned before Congress this week to answer more questions about the agency's targeting of conservative groups for extra scrutiny prior to the 2012 elections, and somehow managed to destroy what is left of his agency's credibility. Under relentless questioning by incredulous Republican congressmen, Koskinen insisted the agency could not retrieve 2 years' worth of lost emails to and from Lois Lerner, the official suspected of having singled out conservative groups for IRS scrutiny. Lerner's hard drive, Koskinen said, had been destroyed, and all backup tapes had been erased. It is not unusual for computers anywhere to fail, he said, blaming Congress for budget cuts that forced the IRS to use antiquated computer systems. This stonewalling tells us that Congress is sniffing down the right trail, said Kimberly Strassel in WallStreetJournal.com. Are we really expected to believe that on June 13, 2011, 10 days after congressional Republicans first wrote to the IRS about the targeting of conservatives, Lerner's hard drive supposedly defied modernity and suffered total annihilation? The timing looks awfully suspicious, said Megan McArdle in BloombergView.com. But as a former email administrator, I can tell you that Lerner's story is entirely plausible. Lerner's hard drive seems to have failed the way most aging hard drives do, a victim of bad sectors. On August 5, 2011, the IRS's tech people notified Lerner that the data on her hard drive was unrecoverable. There is also an innocent explanation for why there is no backup. IRS employees were each allotted a paltry 500 megabytes of server space, and once that was filled up, the system would start storing all new messages locally on the computer's hard drive. Meanwhile, backup tapes on servers were erased every 6 months so they could be reused. This backward policy left the IRS wide open to losing important records. A close look at the timing proves there's no scandal here, said Michael Tomasky in thedailybeast.com. Lerner's hard drive crashed on June 13, 2011, but we know she first learned that Republicans were inquiring about the targeting of conservative groups on June 29th. Yes, House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dave Camp had written to the IRS back on June 3rd, but contrary to Republican assertions, that letter was on a different topic: gift taxes on individuals who donated money to nonprofit advocacy groups. That letter was sent to then-Commissioner Doug Shulman with Lerner not copied in, and made not a single mention of conservative targeting. Lerner, in other words, would need to be a clairvoyant to have sabotaged her own computer in advance of this phony scandal. Poor Republican, said Heather Digby Parton in Salon.com. The right has been praying for a Democratic Watergate for years, but those pesky facts keep getting in the way. Democrats shouldn't chuckle themselves to sleep just yet, said James Poulos in thedailybeast.com. The IRS is not a popular institution, to put it mildly, and voters won't find it hard to believe the agency was used as a tool of political oppression. If Democrats simply dismiss this whole affair as just another conspiracy from unhinged conservatives, it could backfire. Sometimes stuff just happens, Lerner emailed the IRS techs in 2011 after her emails vanished. Sometimes that kind of indifferent attitude toward incompetency costs political parties big elections. Well, it was a good week for Freudian analysis after an American exchange student in Germany climbed inside a giant stone sculpture of a vagina, became stuck, and had to be pulled free by 22 firefighters. He was really embarrassed, said a witness. It was a good week for self-defense after a 63-year-old woman with lung cancer chased a burglar out of her Indiana home by repeatedly whacking him with a wooden back scratcher. I don't think he expected an overweight woman on oxygen to attack him, said Patty Kearney. And it was a good week for partiers after a New York City firm called IV Doc began charging $250 to send a nurse to a hungover person's home to intravenously administer restorative fluid. If you go in feeling like a two, said a customer, you come out a half hour later, feeling like a seven. It was a bad week for Luis Suarez, a Uruguayan soccer star who sank his teeth into the shoulder of Italy's Giorgio Chiellini during a World Cup match. the third time Suarez has been caught biting a rival player. It was a bad week for Rocking the Boat after a motorboat crashed into floating runway lights at New York's LaGuardia Airport when the captain allegedly left the helm to engage in a drunken menage a trois. "There's a moral here," said police. "Drop your anchor before you drop your pants." And it was a bad week for Staying Connected after police arrested a burglary suspect who logged into his Facebook profile during a break-in at a Minnesota home and left it up on the computer screen. "World's dumbest criminal," said homeowner James Wood. And while we're here, only in America, an ex-Goldman Sachs trader is suing the investment bank because it awarded him a discretionary bonus of only $8.25 million, almost $5 million less than he told his mother he was getting. "Let's be very clear," said Deeb Amin Salim, 35, at his arbitration hearing. "I was one of the most sought-after investment professionals in the mortgage industry." Goldman calls his lawsuit utterly ridiculous. We'll turn now over to the briefing page. Ireland's disaffected Catholics. Disgusted by waves of scandal, Ireland's Catholics are boycotting Mass and turning their backs on the Church. How Catholic was Ireland? It used to be easily the most Catholic country in the world. The Church's connection to the island nation dates to St. Patrick's conversion in the 5th century, and the modern Irish state is explicitly bound up with the Church. The Constitution opens with words, "In the name of the Most Holy Trinity, from whom is all authority," and continues with references to obligations to our divine Lord Jesus Christ, who sustained our fathers through centuries of trial. In Ireland, the Church, not the state, runs almost the entire education system. Until recently, social life, too, revolved around the local church. In 1984, nearly 90% of Irish Catholics went to Mass every week. But by 2011, only 18% did. It's a massive cultural shift. What changed? Mass attendance began dropping rapidly during the 1990s, as Ireland began its Celtic Tiger economic boom. The country was modernizing, urbanizing, and taking on a more global perspective, and the local church was no longer the only nexus of community life. For the first time, the country had a vigorous debate about abortion and began teaching sex education in schools. At the same time, several long-hidden scandals began to emerge. In 1992, the Irish learned that a powerful and beloved bishop, Eamon Casey, had fathered a son, and that the Reverend Michael Cleary, the singing priest with best-selling records and his own radio show, had a secret family with his housekeeper. But the biggest seismic jolt came over the last decade, when the priestly sex abuse scandal horrified the entire country. How widespread was the abuse? The scale was greater in Ireland than in any other country. Across the world, the Vatican routinely protected individual priests who were raping boys and, to a lesser extent, girls, responding to complaints of abuse by transferring offenders to other parishes. Ireland had hundreds of such cases, but because of the Church's enormous power there, it was not just individual priests who were involved, but large institutions. Until the 1990s, the Church ran orphanages and industrial schools that warehoused 30,000 children deemed delinquents, pickpockets, or the poor, or those with unmarried parents. The 2009 Ryan Report found that thousands of children were savagely raped or molested in these homes, while thousands more were beaten and starved and forced to work. Boys described nights of terror, lying in bed waiting for priests to come and molest them. In some schools, a high level of ritualized beating was routine, the report said. A new scandal has rocked the church, with the recent discovery that up to 4,000 infants and children, many malnourished and poorly treated, had been buried in unmarked graves at homes for unwed mothers run by Catholic nuns. How had the Irish reacted? The string of revelations has undermined the very legitimacy of the church. To a great extent, the church's authority was premised on control of sexuality. They made this island into a concentration camp where they could control everything. And the control was really all about sex, said Father Mark Patrick Hederman, abbot of Glenstall Abbey. Generations of people were crucified with guilt complexes. Now the game is up. Since priests were the enforcers of sexual purity, to have so many exposed not merely as sexually active, but as sexual predators of children, has deeply shaken Irish faith. The priesthood has lost its luster, and enrollment at seminaries has plummeted. Will there be a priest shortage? There already is. In Dublin, there are just two priests under the age of 40. Across the country, two-thirds of priests are over 55. Some towns are already sharing priests, having mass at the local church only every other week. In about a decade, church authorities say the number of priests in Ireland may decline to 1,500, down from 4,500 a few years ago. And the church will have to start importing priests from other countries. Well over 80% of the Irish still identify as Catholics, but now they practice their religion privately. Tourism at Station Island, where St. Patrick had his religious epiphany in the 5th century, is way up. Disaffected Catholics are using the site as a kind of private church, a way to worship unmediated by the hierarchy. What will the church do? The Association of Catholic Priests, an Irish group, has recommended that women be ordained and that priests be allowed to marry. Surveys have found that the Irish people would support both changes by huge margins, 77% for women's ordination and 87% for married priests. Even in the unlikely event that the Vatican approves such changes, it may be too late to reverse Ireland's secular tide. No one doubts that a growing anti-Catholic element exists in Irish society, Father Gerard Maloney wrote in the Irish Times. The church has provided its enemies with weapons of mass destruction. It has no one to blame but itself. Take a look at a few of the best columns this week. We'll take two from the U.S. The first from the Washington Post, Daniel W. Drenzer. Why Hillary keeps saying she's poor. Hillary Clinton has a bad case of SID, said Daniel W. Drenzer. That's status income disequilibrium, a malady that occurs when successful intellectuals and politicians socialize with Wall Street CEOs, investment bankers, and tycoons, leaving them feeling as if they are unfairly deprived. Just a couple of weeks after complaining that she and Bill were broke when they left the White House, Hillary told an interviewer last week that, unlike a lot of people who are truly well off, we've done it through the dint of hard work. That's incredibly tone-deaf considering that the Clintons have amassed more than $100 million, mostly by giving speeches for $150,000 and up. Why does a very rich Democrat keep insisting she's so underprivileged? Simple. She and Bill spend a lot of their time around hedge fund managers and other billionaires. Indeed, she spent a lot of time soliciting enormous sums of money from these plutocrats for campaigns and Bill's charity. With obvious resentment, Hillary now compares herself to the 0.01%, not to the 99% she claims to champion. Until she gets over her massive case of SID, this kind of gaffe will recur indefinitely. And from Jonathan Chait at nymag.com, the real objection to Obamacare. Remember all those dire conservative predictions about Obamacare? Asked Jonathan Chait. They're failing to come true. Take the claim that only previously insured people were signing up. A new Kaiser Family Foundation survey found that 57% of enrollees previously had no insurance. Meanwhile, the uninsured rate nationally has plunged 25%. The horror stories about the rate shock from soaring premiums? Also bogus. In reality, the average private plan purchased on exchanges costs just $82 a month. Most people with modest incomes are seeing their individual premiums go down, not up. As additional insurers jump into the exchanges, they're putting downward pressure on premiums. Now that it's impossible to deny that millions of Americans are getting affordable health insurance for the first time, conservatives are admitting what really bugs them. Other people's money will pay for it. It's redistribution. Never mind that other people's money, including a fat tax deduction, also subsidizes employer-provided insurance. All along, conservatives hated Obamacare not because it couldn't work, but because they feared it would. In this column from Europe, Italy, Pope Francis excommunicates the mafia. The Pope wants Italy's mobsters to know that they do not walk with God, said Giacomo Galassi in La Stampa. Pope Francis denounced the country's powerful organized crime groups this week during a visit to the southern Italian region of Calabria, where he met with the family of a three-year-old boy killed in January in a mafia hit on his grandfather. Gangsters from Calabria's brutal Drangheta syndicate shot the old man, a family friend, and the boy in the head, and then set their car on fire. This evil act brought forth words of unequivocal condemnation never before issued from the mouth of a pope. Addressing 200,000 people gathered at an outdoor mass, the pope thundered, "Those who in their life have gone along the evil ways, as in the case of the mafia, they are not with God. They are excommunicated." This is nothing less than a revolution in Catholic understanding, said Luigi Acatoli in Corriere della Sera. To put it simply, Italians who do not follow the Church are no longer welcome in it. The Pope has exposed the big lie about so-called men of honor, said Robert Saviano in La Repubblica. The mobsters do not act as Christians, yet they drape themselves in the imagery of Catholicism. The 'Drangheta's initiation rite, for example, involves dripping the new member's blood onto a statue of St. Michael the Archangel. Some might think it a small, obvious thing for the Catholic Church to denounce child killers, but unfortunately it is not. Local priests in mob-plagued areas like Calabria and Sicily are often in league with criminal parishioners, blessing their marriages and allowing them to use church grounds for meetings. For Pope Francis to make his declaration in the heart of Calabria is courageous. Now, to give his words real weight, the Church must take action, such as refusing donations from mobsters and excommunicating those politicians and businessmen who consider themselves Catholics yet have dealings with criminal organizations. In his crackdown on truly evil mobsters, the Pope is showing his progressive instincts, said Vito Mancuso, also in La Repubblica. But he's also used excommunication as a weapon to punish liberal Catholics, such as Austrian Catholic activist Martha Heiser, an honest believer who wanted to open the doors of the Church to everyone. Heiser and her husband celebrated masses at their home without a priest. As a message that dissent would not be tolerated, the Vatican excommunicated the Heisers last month. Why should sincere Catholic reformers get the same punishment as mafiosi who murder little boys? To use excommunication in this heavy-handed way is reminiscent of the Church's less-than-glorious past. Interesting title on the Last Word article this week. The Essence of Jerkitude. It seems that everyone around you is an idiot. If it seems that everyone around you is an idiot, said Eric Schweitzgebel, you may be a jerk. Picture the world through the eyes of the jerk. The line of people in the post office is a mass of unimportant fools. It's a felt injustice that you must wait while they bumble with their requests. The flight attendant is not a potentially interesting person with her own cares and struggles, but instead the most available face of a corporation that stupidly insists you shut your phone. Custodians and secretaries are lazy complainers who rightly get the scut work. The person who disagrees with you at the staff meeting is an idiot to be shot down. Entering a subway is an exercise in nudging past the dumb schmoes. We need a theory of jerks. We need such a theory because, first, it can help us achieve a calm, clinical understanding when confronting such a creature in the wild. And second, well, I don't want to say what the second reason is quite yet. As it happens, I do have such a theory, but before we get into it, I should clarify some terminology. The word jerk can refer to two different types of person. The older use designates a kind of chump or an ignorant fool, though not a morally odious one. The jerk is fool usage seems to have begun as a derisive reference to the unsophisticated people of a jerkwater town, that is, a town not rating a full-scale train station, requiring the boiler man to pull on a chain to water his engine. The term expresses the traveling troop's disdain. Over time, however, jerk shifted from being primarily a class-based insult to its second, now dominant sense, as a term of moral condemnation. It is the immoral jerk who concerns me here. I submit that the unifying core, the essence of jerkitude in the moral sense, is this. The jerk culpably fails to appreciate the perspectives of others around him, treating them as tools to be manipulated or idiots to be dealt with rather than as moral and epistemic peers. This failure has both an intellectual dimension and an emotional dimension, and it has these two dimensions on both sides of the relationship. The jerk himself is both intellectually and emotionally defective, and what he defectively fails to appreciate is both the intellectual and emotional perspectives of the people around him. He can't appreciate how he might be wrong, and others right about some matter of fact. And what other people want or value doesn't register as of interest to him, except derivatively upon his own interests. Some related traits are already well known in psychology and philosophy. The dark triad of Machiavellianism, narcissism, and psychopathy. But my conception of the jerk differs from all of these. The philosopher Aaron James says, the philosopher Aaron James says, is someone who allows himself to enjoy special advantages out of an entrenched sense of entitlement. That is one important dimension of jerkitude, but not the whole story. The callous psychopath, though cousin to the jerk, has an impulsivity and love of risk-taking that need be no part of the jerk's character. Neither does the jerk have to be as thoroughly self-involved as the narcissist or as self-consciously cynical as the Machiavellian, though narcissism and Machiavellianism are common enough jerkish attributes. The opposite of the jerk is the sweetheart, who sees others around him, even strangers, as individually distinctive people with valuable perspectives, whose desires and opinions, interests and goals are worthy of attention and respect. The sweetheart yields his place in line to the hurried shopper, calls an acquaintance with an embarrassed apology after having been unintentionally rude, In a debate, the sweetheart sees how he might be wrong and the other person right. The moral and emotional failure of the jerk is obvious. The intellectual failure is obvious, too. No one is as right about everything as the jerk thinks he is. He would learn by listening, and one of the things he might learn is the true scope of his jerkitude, a fact about which, as I will explain shortly, the all-out jerk is inevitably ignorant. Which brings me to the other great benefit of a theory of jerks. It might help you figure out if you yourself are one. Some clarifications and caveats. First, no one is a perfect jerk or a perfect sweetheart. Human behavior varies hugely with context. Different situations, sales team meetings, traveling, might bring out the jerk in some and the sweetie in others. Second, the jerk is someone who culpably fails to appreciate the perspectives of others around him. Young children and people with severe mental disabilities aren't capable of appreciating others' perspectives, so they can't be blamed for their failure and aren't jerks. Third, I've called the jerk he for reasons you might guess. But then it seems too gendered to call the sweetheart she, so I've made the sweetheart a he too. All normal jerks distribute their jerkishness mostly down the social hierarchy and to anonymous strangers. Waitresses, students, clerks, strangers on the road, those are the unfortunates who bear the brunt of it. With a modicum of self-control, the jerk, though he implicitly or explicitly regards himself as more important than most of the people around him, recognizes that the perspectives of those above him in the hierarchy also deserves some consideration. Often, indeed, he feels sincere respect for his higher-ups. Perhaps respectful feelings are too deeply written in our natures to disappear entirely. Perhaps the jerk retains a vestigial kind of concern specifically for those whom it would benefit him, directly or indirectly, to win over. He is at least concerned enough about their opinion of him to display tactical respect while in their field of view. However, it comes about, the classic jerk kisses up and kicks down. The company CEO rarely knows who the jerks are, though it's no great mystery among the secretaries. Because the jerk tends to disregard the perspectives of those below him in the hierarchy, he often has a little idea of how he appears to them. This leads to hypocrisies. He might rage against the smallest typo in a student's or secretary's document while producing a torrent of errors himself. It just wouldn't occur to him to apply the same standards to himself. He might insist on promptness while always running late. Embarrassment, too, becomes practically impossible for the jerk, at least in front of his underlings. Embarrassment requires us to imagine being viewed negatively by people whose perspectives we care about. As the circle of people whom the jerk is willing to regard as true peers and superiors shrinks, so does his capacity for shame, and with it a crucial entry point for moral self-knowledge. As one climbs the social hierarchy, it is also easier to become a jerk. Here's a characteristically jerkish thought. I'm important, and I'm surrounded by idiots. Both halves of this proposition serve to conceal the jerk's jerkitude from himself. Thinking yourself important is a pleasantly self-gratifying excuse for disregarding the interests and desires of others. Thinking that people around you are idiots seems like a good reason to disregard their intellectual perspectives. As you ascend the hierarchy, you will find it easier to discover evidence about your relative importance, your big salary, your first-class seat, and of the relative idiocy of others who have failed to ascend as high as you. The moralistic jerk is an animal worth special remark. I see in myself and all those who are not pure sweethearts a tendency to rationalize my privilege with moralistic sham justification. Here's my reason for trying to dishonestly wheedle my daughter into the best school. my reason why the session chair should call me on rather, excuse me, should call on me rather than on the grad student who got her hand up earlier. My reason why it's fine that I have 400 library books in my office. The moralizing jerk is apt to go badly wrong in his moral opinions. Partly this is because his morality tends to be self-serving, and partly it's because his disrespect for others' perspectives puts him at a general epistemic disadvantage. But there's more to it than that. In failing to appreciate others' perspectives, the jerk almost inevitably fails to appreciate the full range of human goods. The value of dancing, say, or of sports, nature, pets, local cultural rituals, and indeed anything that he doesn't care for himself. Think of the aggressively rumpled scholar who can't bear the thought that someone would waste her time getting a manicure. Or think of the manicured socialite who can't see the value of dedicating one's life to dusty Latin manuscripts. Whatever he's into, the moralizing jerk exudes a continuous aura of disdain for everything else. Furthermore, mercy is near the heart of practical lived morality. Virtually everything that everyone does falls short of perfection. One's turn of phrase is less than perfect. One arrives a bit late. One's clothes are tacky. One's gesture irritable. One's choice somewhat selfish. One's coffee less than frugal. One's melody trite. Practical mercy involves letting these imperfections pass forgiven, or, better yet, entirely unnoticed. In contrast, the jerk appreciates neither others' difficulties in attaining all the perfections that he attributes to himself, nor the possibility that some portion of what he regards as flawed is in fact blameless. Hard moralizing principle, therefore, comes naturally to him. How can you know your own moral character? You can try a label on for size. Lazy? Unreliable? Is that really me? More effective, I suspect, is to shift from first-person reflection, what am I like, to second-person description. Tell me, what am I like? Instead of introspection, try listening. Ideally, you will have a few people in your life who know you intimately, have integrity, and are concerned about your character. They can frankly and lovingly hold up your flaws to the light and insist that you look at them. Give them the space to do this and prepare to be disappointed in yourself. Done well enough, the second-person approach could work fairly well for traits such as laziness and unreliability, especially if their scope is restricted. Laziness about X, unreliability about Y. But as I suggested above, jerkitude is not so tractable. Since one is far enough gone, if one is far enough gone, one can't listen in the right way. Your critics are fools, at least on this particular topic, their critique of you. They can't appreciate your perspective, you think, though really it's that you can't appreciate theirs. To discover one's degree of jerkitude, the best approach might be neither first-person direct reflection upon yourself, nor second-person conversation with intimate critics, but rather something more third-person, looking in general at other people. Everywhere you turn, you are surrounded by fools, by boring non-entities, by faceless masses and foes and suckers and indeed jerks. Are you the only competent, reasonable person to be found? If your self-rationalizing defenses are low enough to feel a little pang of shame at the familiarity of that vision of the world, then you probably aren't pure diamond-grade jerk. But who is? We're all somewhere in the middle. That's what makes the jerk's vision of the world so instantly recognizable. It's our own vision. But thankfully, only sometimes. This excerpt is taken from an article available in full at Aeon Magazine, AEONmagazine.com. take a look now at the health and science page. First, why dinosaurs dominated the world. Scientists have long debated whether dinosaurs were warm-blooded like birds and mammals or cold-blooded like reptiles and fish. But a new study indicates that the ancient creatures were in fact mesotherms, possessing characteristics of both categories of animals. That dual nature may explain why dinosaurs were able to dominate the prehistoric world. Warm-blooded animals require lots of food, which serves as the fuel that allows them to regulate their internal body temperatures. All that energy also makes them faster and more active than their cold-blooded counterparts, whose body temperatures are affected by the surrounding environment. For the study, researchers compared the size, growth, rate, and metabolism of more than 380 vertebrates, including 21 dinosaur species. Warm-blooded mammals generally metabolize their food about 10 times faster than cold-blooded reptiles do. By studying the growth rings and fossils, scientists found that dinosaurs' metabolic rates fell squarely in the middle of that range. That would have enabled them to survive on less food than mammals while still maintaining their bulk. But with a faster metabolism than cold-blooded reptiles, dinosaurs were more agile, making them both dangerous predators and elusive prey. They took a middle way, kind of like Goldilocks, University of New Mexico ecologist John Grady tells NPR.org, and it seemed to work out very well for them. Secondly here, the downside of being cool. Being popular as a teenager doesn't mean smooth sailing as an adult. In fact, a new decade-long study found that stereotypical cool teens are more likely to stumble socially and have drug and alcohol problems in their 20s. We call it the high school reunion effect, University of Virginia psychologist Joseph Allen tells CNN.com. The student who was popular and was running with the fast crowd isn't doing as great later on. Researchers interviewed 184 7th and 8th graders to identify the social strivers, those who date at a young age, have good-looking friends, and are defiant of authority. Researchers also spoke with the students' parents and friends, then followed up with them at age 22 or 23. Compared with their peers, the adult strivers had 45% higher rates of alcohol and drug problems, and 22% higher rates of criminal behavior. Their ability to have positive relationships was also 24% lower. It may be that as cool kids get older, behaviors that once impressed their friends don't have the same effect, so they turn to increasingly extreme measures to get attention. On the Talking Points page, Iraq. Should the neocons shut up? Don't look now, said Jacob Heilbrum in Politico.com, but the neocons are coming out of the woodwork. With Iraq in pieces and extremist militants marching toward Baghdad, unrepentant Bush-era warmongers such as former Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, former Iraq envoy Paul Bremer, and former Vice President Dick Cheney are going into overdrive to blame the collapse of the country on anyone other than themselves. Primarily, they're blaming the chaos on President Obama's refusal to keep U.S. troops in Iraq in perpetuity. Their gall is unbelievable, said James Fallows in TheAtlantic.com. We're talking about White House officials who got the biggest strategic call in many decades completely wrong. Considering that they launched a war based on non-existent weapons of mass destruction and then horribly botched the occupation, squandering more than $1 trillion, thousands of American lives, and more than 100,000 Iraqi lives, they might have the decency to shut the hell up. Now, I find neoconservative arguments mostly unconvincing, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. But silencing everyone who supported the war isn't exactly conducive to a healthy debate. Let's not forget that while many Republicans supported the war, the same can be said for a majority of Americans and many prominent Democrats, including Secretary of State John Kerry and presidential frontrunner Hillary Clinton. Shouldn't they all shut up too? Liberals can either ignore the people who got Iraq wrong, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com, or they can ask them tough questions about why they got it wrong. That would help with the debate over the merits of limited military intervention in Iraq in 2014, a completely different issue than the disastrous 2003 invasion. This time, the neocons may be right. One voice has been missing from all the commentary on Iraq, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com, and it is that of George W. Bush himself. In his 2010 memoir, Bush maintained that the toppling of Saddam Hussein was the right decision, but admitted deep personal failures in the Iraq misadventure. Such an acknowledgement from his fellow neocons would go a long way toward rebuilding their credibility as they urge a strong response to the crisis. They don't have to grovel. They just have to concede they played a part in creating the problem they now hope to fix. Another one of the talking point articles. Walker, the GOP's 2016 nominee. After Mitt Romney's crushing 2012 defeat, Republicans consoled themselves with the belief that they had a deep bench of future presidential candidates, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Unfortunately, a large number of them appear to be criminals. Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell is facing up to 30 years in prison on corruption charges. In New Jersey, Governor Chris Christie is sweating out a major federal investigation over the George Washington Bridge scandal. Now Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, possibly the new frontrunner in the wake of Christie's demise, has been implicated in a scandal of his own. Last week, a federal judge unsealed documents showing that state prosecutors had investigated whether Walker directed a criminal scheme to circumvent campaign finance laws during his recall election in 2012. So who's next on the Republican roster? Actually, Walker is not in any trouble whatsoever, said Gabrielle Mellor in TheFederalist.com. The unsealed documents also show that both state and federal judges dismissed the prosecutor's case and ordered them to cease their baseless investigation. Liberals are attacking Walker, who successfully pushed through popular union reforms in Wisconsin, because they know he could be a formidable contender for the White House in 2016. But legality isn't the only issue here, said Francis Wilkinson in BloombergView.com. Only a certified dunce would send an email indicating that a candidate was coordinating the work of 12 independent conservative groups, a violation of campaign finance laws. Walker sent just such an email, even though he's seen six aides convicted for violating campaign laws. Do Republicans really want to nominate a numbskull? Walker does have flaws, said Tim Alberta in NationalJournal.com. He lacks charisma and is unremarkable in front of large crowds. But his conservative credentials are impeccable. He cut taxes. He opposes abortion. He turned a massive budget deficit into a surplus. He also supports Second Amendment rights and defeated organized labor. With a political profile so perfectly attuned to his party's right wing, presented in a way that doesn't alienate the establishment, Walker may just be the GOP's likeliest nominee. One small problem, said Heather Digby Parton in Salon.com. Walker first has to win re-election as governor in November, and he and his Democratic challenger are in a dead heat. If he loses this race, he can kiss 2016 goodbye. And a few notes as we wind down the hour. Over half of all U.S. homes, about 71 million housing units, are at risk from natural disasters such as tornadoes, earthquakes, or hurricanes, according to data from the U.S. Geological Survey. At least 10.6 million of those are at a very high risk. Wars and political instability have created more refugees in the world than at any point since World War II, according to the United Nations. By the end of last year, 51.2 million people had been forced from their homes in such countries as Syria, Afghanistan, and Somalia. More than 400 U.S. military drones have crashed since 2001, slamming into homes, farms, runways, highways, waterways, and an airport transport plane in midair. Since 1985, the size of the average fire on federal land has quadrupled, according to the National Interagency Fire Center. One of the top 10 biggest burn years on record, of the top 10 biggest burn years on record, nine have happened since 2000. On the poll watch, 77% of Americans oppose sending ground troops to Iraq, while only 19% support deployment. 56% support using drones, and 43% favor airstrikes to attack ISIS militants. In general, 58% of Americans now disapprove of President Obama's foreign policy. This from the New York Times. And finally, a quote. This comes from Salman Rushdie in the Montreal Gazette. He says, "There is no such thing as perfect security, only varying levels of insecurity." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward. We hope you've enjoyed it. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.